expressly sets out attorney's fees and costs are allowable to the prevailing party. We prevailed. We prevailed at the trial court, both on summary judgment and then through trial. The primary issue was whether or not the defendant, which has a senior mobile home park, had a duty to maintain the non-common premises. Not the common areas, but the non-common premises. Permanent structures.
Now, after summary judgment was granted, they didn't defend on liability, did they?
Correct.
It was just, the trial was only on damages.
Correct. No, you're right, except for proximate cause and damages.
Well, which damages were proximately caused by the fall through the deck?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the action was based in
but
the statute.
But there was no dispute your client was injured.
Correct. There was no, never has been a dispute our client was injured. The question was who was liable for that and then what the total amounts were that they were liable for. So the action itself was centered, arose from, planted in the statute. No question on that.
This isn't a criticism, but why in your motion for summary judgment didn't you include the issue of attorney's fees?
It was done twice. So normally we do step by step. We would do the first step to establish the liability. Both the contract is void and unenforceable, and the motion for summary judgment under the statute. Then the second one, as you know, we did apply for attorney's fees once we prevailed. You could spend a lot of time determining the amount of the fees at that stage that would then continue to get added on once you prevailed, and then you have to determine it, and then you go back in. So you could have several steps. In fact, here, the criticism actually was that by doing it in two steps, once before trial at the conclusion of prevailing on summary judgment, it was premature. We shouldn't have done it then. We should have just done it once at the very end of trial. So I appreciate the criticism, but we would have got it either way.
Not at all. I think you did the case well, and it was an interesting strategy.
Yeah, and so we had it sort of either way. It did get deferred. So one thing that's clean here, as sometimes others, is what the amount of fees were through summary judgment, because then right after that, then we applied for the fees and costs and then did it again at the back end for a total amount because that decision was deferred for a lump sum at the back. It wasn't the defendant's position that you don't get fees and costs then.
You know, an interesting thing about the instructions is that they don't mention the Mobile Home Landlord-Tenant Act with respect to this first claim. It just says the defendant's negligence has already been established. The jury wasn't instructed on what negligence is or what, but it strikes me that perhaps one of the reasons for the confusion here is that negligence kind of sounds to, at least superficially, like a common law tort claim, perhaps premises liability. But as I read your complaint, you did not even plead liability of a possessor of land.
Well, correct. It was notice pleading, but yes, we did not go through the details as to the particularities of a non-common common law action. So a non-common area, possessor, latent defects,
you
notice.
You called it a premises liability action, but you did not refer to the common law or the restatement or anything like
that. We did do the common law, yes. But yes, it was called a premises liability action, the premises being a mobile home park, and we pled then the mobile home landlord-tenant act.
What do you mean you did do a common law claim? I didn't see it.
Yes, it would be generalized, again, under the notice pleading, but everyone understood that, which is why when we moved, we pointed out there are three theories one can pursue. The part that was of original interest to us, to me, was whether or not we would, the issue of adopting restatement property 17.6. within the context of the statute, which would then mean you get the floor of attorney's fees and costs plus the personal injury damages, as Division 2 and Division 3 have done.
Is that somewhere in the pleadings? That
yes.
Where exactly?
Yes, and you'll see that. Well, you'll see it in the motion itself for summary judgment with a reference to Leon and Martini. You'll see it in Ms. Anderson's declaration for fees. I want to say clerk's papers 61, 55 to 61. She sets forth the different theories that we were pursuing. It became moot when we prevailed on summary judgment, and then they just admitted across the board, didn't anticipate the fact that they would then say the statute fell out. That was, it's a novel, unique argument that's unprecedented that common law would preempt a statutory remedy.
But you understand that that was what their position was, that the common law
statute fell out?
No, not at the time. That's what their position on appeal was. At the time, it was first defer this to the end to see whether they're the prevailing party or not, and the total amount of fees and things. And then it was this mixture of it's either common law or statute, never the two shall meet. It's only one or the other, and they're exclusive remedies, mutually exclusive, which there's just no precedent for, which as I believe is their alternative argument now is probable error, but just limited to the time.
You have your 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Yes, thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Amber Pierce on behalf of respondents Keith Johnson and Colonial Park. I'd like to make 4 points. The first one is that after further consideration and legal analysis, respondents believe that the trial court likely erred under de novo review and that Ms. Tolman is likely entitled to attorney fees and costs solely under the Mobile Home Landlord-Tenant Act and solely for prevailing on a statutory violation. But she is not entitled to fees and costs for the Consumer Protection Act claim because she did not prevail on that claim.
What about the contract?
She is, with respect to the contract.
There was an attorney's fees provision in the contract.
Yes, Your Honor.
We understand your statement about the Consumer Protection Act.
Yes.
They're not arguing for fees based on the CPA.
Well, let me reach Judge Cox's question first, and then Judge Becker, I'll answer yours. The on the attorney fees and costs in the contract, there's three separate sentences that speak to fees, and our position is that she's obviously not entitled to fees and costs under the first sentence because that's a tenant.
We spend a lot of time. Why does it make any difference whether we award fees under the statute or the contract?
It only makes a slight difference, and here's the point I want to make. Sentence 2 says, if any legal action arising out of the agreement, including eviction, the prevailing party shall be entitled to reasonable fees and costs. I believe that she's entitled to reasonable fees and costs under that sentence only. However, the third sentence, I do not believe that she's entitled to reasonable fees and costs because that is strictly for a breach of contract or a default on the part of either party. This is not a breach of contract claim. It's not a default claim. She doesn't get fees and costs under that third sentence. But under the second sentence, yes.
Of the lease we're speaking of here?
Of the lease, which is at CP 159.
So you think, you're telling us she gets fees under the Mobile Home Landlord-Tenant Act?
Correct.
And she gets fees under the lease, but only under the third sentence?
Only under the second sentence.
Only under the second sentence. Okay, now to follow up with what Judge Leach is asking, is this going to make a difference in terms of how much fees they get? Or why are we here? I mean, in other words, why not just call up and say we throw in the towel? We're not going to argue.
Well, 2 points. One, that was an issue that I couldn't fully resolve before oral argument today. And two, there's been a squabble about the Consumer Protection Act claim. Mm-hmm. On appeal, she's trying to claw back her costs for that. Her opening brief says that she's not seeking fees and costs for her Consumer Protection Act claim, but her reply brief says that she's entitled to fees and costs for the entire litigation. And that's not true because she didn't prevail on the CPA claim.
We could segregate out, if it was possible, the lawyer's effort attributable to the Consumer Protection Act claim, and then whatever else is left, she would be entitled to recover.
Your Honor, I completely agree. And
let me ask you another question. There's a body of case law that says sometimes if you can't segregate out your time, it's not possible to do it, then you get the whole amount. Is that something that's at issue here?
Well, I think that would be more at issue in the trial court on remand.
So we don't need to worry about it.
That's correct. And we will be arguing fervently that she must disentangle her CPA claim from her statutory violation claim, and I understand
that you've taken all of the issues out. How do you respond to an argument that you can't disentangle?
I would look to Bowers and the whole body of cases that says it's required. So, but I wouldn't prepare to make that argument before this court. The last point
is
I want.
Is there any part of your response brief that you're standing behind this morning? Any argument in there that we need to address?
Well, the only thing I really want to respond at this point is that, well, one, she's not entitled to fees under sentence 3 of the agreement, and two, it's very clear how this claim became conflated for both the trial court and on appeal for a premises liability claim, because in her reply brief, she argues that she couldn't, that she had to wait 3 years to move for summary judgment on the statutory violation because she had to prove that the deck was defective and the defendants had actual or constructive notice with time to repair it. Now, that sounds like a cause of action of premises liability, and that's in her reply at page 22. She also says that she had to hire an expert to talk about the condition of the deck and the maintenance of the deck.
All those things, even if she's making a claim under the contract or the statute?
Not if we've already conceded at summary judgment that there's a statutory violation.
When you have to show something's proximately caused by something, don't you have to show all that information?
You may, not for the statutory violation, but yes, for the CPA. However, she didn't prevail on that.
For any claim, don't you have to show what caused the injury?
At this point, the jury is only writing in numbers for how much her damages were that resulted from the statutory violation.
It strikes me that I mean, what it sounds like here is that you've recognized that you're probably going to lose, you know, your arguments that you made in your brief, or at least you're going to lose on the idea that neither the lease nor the attorney nor the statute provides for attorney's fees. You're conceding that they do, but what you're hoping to do is to go back and save the day by once again engaging the trial court in the idea of that it somehow didn't arise out of a breach and so on and so forth. I mean, you're trying to put yourself in a position to go back and not have to and argue to the trial court to only give them, say, half of their attorney's fees. Maybe only the attorney's fees that came after summary judgment or before summary judgment. Is that what you're trying to do?
Well, we did argue in the brief that she was only entitled to fees through October 16th, 2015, when she moved for summary judgment on the statutory violation.
Okay, so that's something we can decide.
Yes.
I'm just trying to figure out what you're trying to do, because it sounds to me, on one hand, you're trying to say, we lose. They get to go back and they get all their attorney's fees. But then at the same time, you're saying, no,
okay,
we'll go back to the trial court and we'll say that, yes, they're entitled to fees under the contract and under the statute, but not all their fees. And in fact, they're probably only entitled to a fraction of their fees.
Well, to be perfectly...
I just don't, not sure how that isn't going to be resolved by what we decide based on the arguments in the briefs, which is what we do.
Right.
I thought you conceded earlier that except for the fees devoted to the Consumer Protection Act, everything else was available for recovery by the plaintiff.
Yes, I agree with that. And to be clear, I agree.
So that would be all of the fees at trial except the time spent trying to prove the Consumer Protection Act claim.
That is correct.
And that's going to be all the fees on appeal as well.
Well, that's only if you don't buy the argument that those fees should have stopped on October 15th.
So you're adhering to that argument?
I am.
Okay.
So we need to resolve that so the trial court will know whether that's a correct argument.
That's correct, and yes. And that she only gets fees for the statutory violation, not the CPA claim. And that on remand she should strike that. And the trial court should determine whether or not she can disentangle her CPA fees from her.
Well, it'll be up to her to decide whether that's possible or whether she wants to advance the argument that they can't be unwound or too intertwined.
I will point out that it's unfortunate.
Do you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor. That respondents are being penalized for plaintiffs waiting 3 years to move for summary judgment on statutory violation and incurring these fees and costs.
You the day you got the complaint, didn't you?
That's true, too.
So, I mean, what's good for the goose is good for the gander in that argument.
Yeah.
Are we done?
I think we are.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I certainly don't want to talk myself out of a conceded victory. I would point out this is the same thing that happened at the trial court. We were forced all the way through summary judgment to the hearing.
When does that matter now?
You know, it really doesn't, other than the fact that...
You heard what I just said.
Yeah. No, I got you, and I agree with you that we should get fees throughout.
Are you trying to do you agree that you shouldn't get fees for time spent litigating the Consumer Protection Act? Because there was quite a bit of time spent on that, was there not?
There was time on that only to the extent it overlapped entirely. I think Justice Leach has it correct that those are so intertwined, and they've always been intertwined. Now, there hasn't been a squabble.
Well, there was, you had a motion for JNOV.
Correct.
Why would that be a recoverable?
And that probably wouldn't. I agree with that. So that part could be separated out to the extent.
What you're telling us is there may be some you can segregate, but there may be some you can't, and
yes,
you need
sir.
To go back and do your homework.
Yes, sir. That's actually what we said in the brief, too, 23 and 24 in the reply. There is no squabble on that, that upon remand, the trial court can segregate those out if, in fact, there is any issue.
What's this three-year argument, as far as you can tell?
Sort of like the year-and-a-half argument now on appeal, that it took 3 years before we were able to get a summary judgment hearing before the trial court to resolve it, and now it took another year-and-a-half on appeal before we were able to get them to concede that we are entitled to fees. So they took 3 years fighting it to begin with, and now another year and a half fighting the right to fees before, when we get a hearing, then they concede. Not before, and there's been no contact before saying, we'd like to resolve this, or we agree with part of your position or not.
Are you aware of any case where someone has faced a reduction in attorney's fees because of the timing of their summary judgment?
No.
This is not the proper court to resolve Lodestar issues in any event, right?
Generally, yes, sir.
Okay.
We don't have a record of proceedings for the most part, so we don't really know how this came about in front of the trial court. It's puzzling, really. Do you have any insight that you care to offer us as to why the trial court would make the mistake that is now conceded with respect to saying that the fees don't arise out of either the lease or the contract?
Yes. It can be very easy for a court to view things in segregated boxes. Economic loss rule, the independent duty doctrine is one that does that. You either go one direction or the other. It's not both. So it can happen. I understand that. And if one was persuasive to say it's one or the other but not both, but then again, that's why we have the Court of Appeals with learned folks that can reconcile those things and say, okay, maybe you were successful, improperly so down below, but we can correct that now. And it's also nice that counsel, at least at this point, before you, concedes the obvious. It would have been nicer beforehand, so, but I enjoyed the time, and I appreciate the questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The next matter is Rubel.